You will hear a telephone conversation between an employee of an airline company and a customer. You have 30 seconds to look at questions 1 to 6.
GB Airlines, this is Kyle speaking. How can I help?
Hi, my name is Matt Walsh. I'm calling on behalf of Mr. John Sparrow to claim expenses for a delay in his flight last week.
Good morning, Mr. Walsh. Thank you for calling. Could you please tell me the flight number and the date of departure?
The date of departure was the 24th of January, 2016. I'm afraid I don't have the flight number in front of me at the moment.
Okay, that's all right. One moment. Could you tell me, where was Mr. Sparrow departing from?
He was departing from Athens.
Is that Athens, Greece, or Athens, Georgia?
Athens, Greece.
Right. And what was the destination?
It was Heathrow, London.
Right. We've got two flights from Athens to London, Heathrow, on the 24th of January, 2016. Was it the 3:25 p.m. flight or the 9:45 p.m.?
It was the later one, 9:45.
Okay, so the flight number is GB1011.
Right, okay.
Okay, yes. I can see that Mr. Sparrow's flight was cancelled and he was booked on the next flight on the 25th of January at 3:25 p.m. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
According to our system, one of my colleagues spoke with Mr. Sparrow on the phone on the 24th to inform him of the cancellation and offered to book a hotel for him for the night, but Mr. Sparrow preferred to book one himself.
Yes, because he didn't want to stay near the airport, as the next flight was in the afternoon.
Yes, of course. Could you tell me which hotel he stayed at?
Yes, he stayed at the Hypnos Hotel.
Could you spell that for me?
Of course. That's H-Y-P-N-O-S.
Right. Thank you for that. And could you please tell me how much the total cost was for the night?
Sure. It was €73.
Right. Do you have a copy of the receipt for that?
Yes, of course. Would you like me to send it to you?
Yes, please.
Can I email a picture of it to you?
Absolutely. The email address is refunds@gbairlines.co.uk.
Great. Thank you.
No problem. Were there any other expenses you wish to claim?
Actually, yes. There was also the taxi ride to the airport and the taxi ride back the next day.
Right. And what was the total cost?
The first taxi ride was €53 and the second one was 42. So 63, 73, 83. Yeah, so the total was €95. I'll send you the receipt for those as well.
Thank you. Are there any other expenses?
No, I think that's it.
You now have 30 seconds to look at questions 7 to 10.
Excellent. So if you could please send us the receipts for the hotel and the taxi rides, and after we receive them, it should take about 48 hours for the funds to reach Mr. Sparrow's account.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Is there anything else I can help you with?
Actually, yes. There's one more thing. Mr. Sparrow complained about the meal during the flight. He said that it was a bit bland.
Right.
So he asked me if it was possible to switch to a different meal option for his upcoming flight to Kiev next week.
Right, of course. Just give me a minute, please. Right, I see that Mr. Sparrow had the light meal option for his flight to London, and you would like to change that. What would you like to change it to?
What are the other options?
We've got 12 different meal options. Would you like me to list all of them for you?
Well, Mr. Sparrow has told me that he would prefer something without meat. How many of these do not contain meat?
We've got three meal options without meat. We've got the vegetarian option, the vegan option, and the Asian vegetarian.
What's the difference?
There's a variety of different dishes served with each option. For example, next week, the vegetarian option will be a small spinach and feta cheese pie, a bread roll, a salad, and tropical fruit.
And the vegan option?
The vegan option doesn't include any dairy products, and it also doesn't include fowl, eggs, or honey. I'm afraid I don't have the specific menu for this week, but I can email it to you as soon as it becomes available.
Oh, could you do that? That would be great.
Yes, of course. I can email you a detailed description of all the meal options if you like.
Yes, please.
No problem. Please do not forget to call us back to change the meal option. You need to do that 48 hours before the departure time for international flights and 24 hours for domestic flights.
So 48 hours for this one then?
Yes, exactly.
Perfect.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. Transatlantic flights require 48 hours. All flights within Europe require 24 hours. So in this case, you will need to call us 24 hours in advance. I apologize for that.
Okay, great.
So, could I please have your email address so I can send you the menus?
Certainly. It's matt.walsh@sparrowlimited.com.
You will hear a conversation between a radio presenter and an author. You have 30 seconds to look at questions 11 to 14.
And here with us today, we have Patricia Abedin, author of the best-selling book Beginner's Guide to Self-Publishing and owner of the self-publishing company Make a Book.
Hello.
Hello, Patricia. Now, I know a lot of our listeners are interested in self-publishing their novels, but they don't know where to start. As a successful self-published author, what would you say are some of the pitfalls they'd need to avoid?
I'm glad you asked that, Mark. The thing is that with the ebook revolution that started in the early 2000s, we experienced a shift in the literary market, and suddenly aspiring writers didn't have to rely on agents and traditional publishers anymore to get the opportunity to publish their books. But just because we can publish, does that mean we should? For me, there are four questions that each writer needs to ask themselves before they attempt to join the market. The first question is my book ready? One of the biggest mistakes new writers do is that they get so excited with the prospect of publishing their book that they rush through the process and they don't bother with the technicalities such as thorough editing. And they should, because editing is about 50% of the final product. It's not as glamorous as the process of actually creating the story, but it's just as important. The final product needs to be immaculate. Not just in terms of grammar, but also in terms of plotting, characterization, and even spelling. Secondly, do I understand the market? Unless you're publishing just for your friends and family, you need to have a sound marketing strategy. The beauty of self-publishing is that anyone can do it, but that also means that you're fighting for attention against millions of other titles. Do you know what sets your book apart? Do you understand who your audience is and how you're going to reach them? Do you have a solid presence in social media? In general, do you know how you're going to sell the book to people? The third question, and I hope I don't sound too pragmatic, is, have I worked out how much money I'm willing to spend? This extends beyond the cost of self-publishing itself, obviously. There's the cost of advertising, the cost of proofreading and copy editing, the cost of giving away free copies to reviewers, and let's not forget the cost of a professionally done cover. The truth is that the more you see your book as an investment, the more of a return you're going to get. But either way, you need to know what your available funds are. And the final thing is something most writers overlook, but it's just as important as the other three. Have I started my next project yet? Remember, one book is never going to make you rich, and it's never going to make you famous. If you want to succeed, you need to keep writing and keep publishing as many books as you can. That's how you build an audience and how you get your book to the top of the charts.
You now have 30 seconds to look at questions 15 to 17.
Thank you, Patricia. So tell us, how did you do it? You started publishing 5 years ago, and now you have your own publishing company. How did you get here so fast?
To be honest with you, the first book I ever published was a flop, and it was because I didn't follow almost any of the rules I just told you. My novel was poorly edited, it had a cheap-looking, self-made cover, and I had no idea how to get people to buy it. For about a year, I checked its dismal sales every month, and I wallowed in self-pity. But then, I decided it was time to change and do something. The first thing I did was get a subscription to all the writing magazines I could find out there. I'd read them all from cover to cover and followed the experts' advice as if it was gospel. I wrote almost every single day, and I submitted short stories to every competition I could find out there. I also started a blog and I set up my own page. Over time, I started building a name for myself and a solid fan base.
You now have 30 seconds to look at questions 18 to 20.
I didn't want to be associated with my first book, so I decided to publish my next book under a different name. This time, I sought professional help with editing, and I spent months working on it until it was ready. I also sought the advice of friends who worked in marketing and tech-savvy friends who helped me come up with a marketing plan. Since I already had a platform, my website and my social media pages, it was much easier to reach the people who would be interested in reading my book. And of course, while all of this was happening, I was also in the middle of my next novel, which I planned to have ready for editing by the time the previous one was out. So, yeah, I published my second book about 2 years after my first, and it was a completely different experience. And now, here I am.
Thank you very much, Patricia. I'm sure our listeners have been inspired by your story.
Section 3. You will hear two university students, Phil and Stella, talking to their tutor about their research project. First, you have some time to look at questions 21 to 27 on pages 69 and 70. Now listen carefully and answer questions 21 to 27.
Come in. Ah, yes, Stella. Is Phil there too?
Mm-hmm.
Good. Come on in. Okay, so you're here to discuss your research project. Have you decided what to focus on? You were thinking of something about the causes of mood changes, weren't you?
Yes, but the last time we saw you, you suggested we narrowed it down to either the effects of weather or urban environment. So we've decided to focus on the effects of weather.
Right, that's more manageable. So your goal is, Phil?
To prove the hypothesis, no. To investigate the hypothesis that the weather has an effect on a person's mood.
Hmm, good. And what's your thesis, Stella?
Well, our thesis is that in general, when the weather's good, it has a positive effect on a person's mood, and bad weather has a negative effect.
Hmm. Can you define your terms here? For example, what do you mean by good and bad?
OK, well, good would be sunny, warm weather, and bad would be when it's cold and cloudy or raining.
And how would you define an effect on a person's mood? What would you be looking to find?
An effect on the way a person feels.
Hmm?
A change in the way they feel? Like from feeling happy and optimistic to sad and depressed.
Right. And what sort of weather variables will you be looking at?
Oh, sunshine, temperature, cloudiness, precipitation, among others. It'll depend a bit what the weather's like when we do the survey.
Fine. We'll talk about that in a minute. But first, what about background reading? I gave you some suggestions. Did you manage to read any of it?
Yes. We read the Ross Vickers article, the one comparing the groups of American Marines training in summer and winter.
Hmm.
That's quite relevant to our study. It was interesting because the Marines who were training in the cold winter conditions tried to cheer themselves up by thinking of warm places, but it didn't really work.
Yes, they were trying to force themselves to have a positive mental outlook, but in fact it had the opposite effect, and they ended up in a very negative state of mind.
And we found some more research by someone who wasn't on the reading list you gave us, George Whitebourne. He compared people living in three countries with very different climatic conditions. Actually, he looked at several things, not just the weather. But he found some people's reactions to bad weather were much worse than others, and it was linked to how stressed they were generally. The weather on its own didn't have such a significant effect on mood.
And we looked at a paper by Haverton. Yeah. He broke weather up into about 15 or 16 categories and did qualitative and quantitative research. He found that humans respond to conditions in the weather with immediate responses, such as fear or amazement. But these responses can also be linked to associations from their earlier life, such as a particular happy or sad event.
Did you have a look at Stanfield's work?
Yes. It was interesting because the type of questions he asked were similar to what we were planning to use in our survey.
Yes.
He asked people how they were feeling on days with good and bad weather. He found the biggest factor seemed to be the humidity. Moods were most negative on days with a lot of rainfall. Long periods without sunshine had some effect, but nothing like as much.
Hmm. That could be quite a useful model for your project.
Yes, we thought so too. Although we can't continue our survey for as long as he did. He did his over a 6-month period.
You now have some time to look at questions 28 to 30 on page 70. Now listen and answer questions 28 to 30.
Right. Well, you've made quite a good start. So, where are you going from here?
Well, we've already made the questionnaire we're going to use for the survey. It's quite short, just 8 questions. We're aiming to survey 20 people over a period of 3 months from October to December.
We can't specify the actual dates yet because it depends on the weather. We want to do the survey on days with a range of different weather conditions. And we'll just be working on campus, so our data will only be statistically sound for the student population here.
That's OK. Have you thought how you'll determine what will constitute each aspect of weather and how many you're looking at?
We decided on 4. The amount of sunshine, cloudiness, temperature and precipitation. We thought we might use the internet to get data on weather conditions on the days we do the survey, but we haven't found the information we need. So we might have to measure it ourselves. We'll see.
Then we've got to analyse the results, and we'll do that using a spreadsheet, giving numeric values to answers. And then, of course, we have to present our findings to the class, and we want to make it quite an interactive session. We want to involve the class in some way in the presentation, maybe by trying to create different climatic conditions in the classroom, but we're still thinking about it.
I see. Well, that sounds as if you're on the right lines. Now, what I'd suggest that you think about, in addition to the work you've done.
That is the end of Section 3. You now have half a minute to check your answers. Now turn to Section 4 on page 71. Section 4. You will hear a lecturer in education talking about some experiments done in the USA to investigate the effects of reducing class sizes. First, you have some time to look at questions 31 to 40 on pages 71 and 72. Now listen carefully and answer questions 31 to 40.
All over the world, there are passionate arguments going on about how educational systems can be improved. And of all the ideas for improving education, few are as simple or attractive as reducing the number of pupils per teacher. It seems like common sense. But do these ideas have any theoretical basis? Today, I want to look at the situation in the USA and at some of the research that has been done here in America on the effects of reducing class sizes. In the last couple of decades or so, there has been considerable concern in the United States over educational standards here, following revelations that the country's secondary school students perform poorly relative to many Asian and European students. In addition, statistics have shown that students in the nation's lower-income schools in the urban areas have achievement levels far below those of middle-class and upper-middle-class schools. So would reducing class sizes solve these problems? Well, we have to remember that it does have one obvious drawback. It's expensive. It requires more teachers and possibly more classrooms, equipment, and so on. On the other hand, if smaller classes really do work, the eventual economic benefits could be huge. Better education would mean that workers did their jobs more efficiently, saving the country millions of dollars. It would also mean that people were better informed about their health, bringing savings in things like medical costs and days off sick. So what reliable information do we have about the effects of reducing class sizes? There's plenty of anecdotal evidence about the effect on students' behavior, but what reliable evidence do we have for this? Let's have a look at three research projects that have been carried out in the USA in the last couple of decades or so. The first study I'm going to look at took place in the state of Tennessee in the late 1980s. It involved some 70 schools. In its first year, about 6,400 students were involved, and by the end of the study, 4 years later, the total number involved had grown to 12,000. What happened was that students entering kindergarten were randomly assigned to either small classes of 13 to 17 students or regular-sized classes of 22 to 26. The students remained in whatever category they had been assigned to through the third grade, and then, after that, they joined a regular classroom. After the study ended in 1989, researchers conducted dozens of analyses of the data. Researchers agree that there was significant benefit for students in attending smaller classes, and it also appears that the beneficial effect was stronger for minority students. However, there's no agreement on the implications of this. We still don't know the answer to questions like how long students have to be in smaller classes to get a benefit, and how big that benefit is, for example. The second project was much larger and took place in California. Like the Tennessee study, it focused on students from kindergarten through to grade 3, but in this case, all schools throughout the state were involved. The experiment is still continuing, but results have been very inconclusive, with very little improvement noted. And the project has, in fact, also had several negative aspects. It meant an increased demand for teachers in almost all California districts. So the better-paying districts got a lot of the best teachers, including a fair number that moved over from the poorer districts. And there were a lot of other problems with the project. For example, there weren't any effective procedures for evaluation. All in all, this project stands as a model of what not to do in a major research project. A third initiative took place in the state of Wisconsin at around the same time as the California project began, and it's interesting to compare the two. The Wisconsin project was small. Class sizes were reduced in just 14 schools, but it was noteworthy because it targeted schools at which a significant proportion of the students were from poor families, compared with California's one-size-fits-all approach. Analysts have found that the results are very similar to the Tennessee project, with students making gains that are statistically significant and that are considerably larger than those calculated for the California initiative. Now, I'd like to apply some of these ideas to the latest.
That is the end of Section 4. You now have half a minute to check your answers. That is the end of the listening test. You now have 10 minutes to transfer your answers to the separate answer sheet.